What Christians call the Old Testament, scholars call the Hebrew Scriptures. We'll be giving you insights from the Hebrew of the Hebrew Scriptures today.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Do you know how we came up with the name Thoroughly Jewish Thursday? Do you know where we got that from? I'll tell you in a moment. Michael Brown, delighted to be with you on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. And I'm taking any questions you have whatsoever having to do with the Hebrew language, having to do with specific words in the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, having to do with questions about Jewish traditions or Jewish beliefs, having to do with questions perhaps about Jewish background to the New Testament. Let's separate myth from fact today. Let's give you some really good insights from the Word, and we'll do our best to answer your questions. So here's the number to call, 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-348-7884. Your questions are warmly welcomed. You've wondered about, what is this? I've heard this. Is it really true? Go for it. Let's dig into the Word together, and I've got some really neat things to share with you that'll be eye-opening and edifying. You can also post your question on my Facebook page, which is Ask Dr. Brown, A-S-K-D-R Brown on Facebook, and I will do my best to get to as many questions as possible. When we transitioned, greatly expanded this radio ministry a couple years back, went from a number of great stations all over North Carolina and a number of other states to the stations we're on now across the country, I really felt that I wanted to be more thematic in the way I approach the week. Now, any day we can talk about anything, if there's something pressing in the news or the Lord's laid something on my heart, because it is live talk radio. But we established Monday's musings, just anything that's on my mind after the weekend, something I'm burdened with, something I want to talk about, that's Monday. Tuesday, teaching. Focus on the Word, theology, apologetics, practical living. Wednesday, the world. Moral, cultural issues. Friday, we didn't have a rhyme with that or alliteration with that. But Friday, you've got questions, we've got answers. Thursday was our Jewish day. And I didn't have something that worked well for Thursday. And one of our dear listeners, perhaps listening this very moment with a smile, said, how about Thoroughly Jewish Thursday? So you were co-workers in that process. Okay, a quick little Hebrew insight. I was flying to Orlando Tuesday night. In fact, I've been flying a lot last few days and about to fly a whole lot more as we leave for India tomorrow. And thank you, those that have sent in support to help. We continue to use your help and support. That'd be great. But flying to Orlando, flight was delayed on Tuesday night, and sitting next to a young man, we got to chatting, and turns out he was a believer, and a serious believer, committed, mid-20s. So I said, hey, do you have a question about anything, you know, a scriptural question, just like I'm doing here on the radio? And he said, yeah, he just posted on his Facebook page, or posted somewhere, Jeremiah 29:11, a well-known verse to many of you, where God says to the exiles in Babylon, I know the thoughts or the plans I have for you, plans for shalom, for well-being, plans for blessing, not for evil, not for destruction. Anyway, well-known verse. I'm paraphrasing some of it for a reason. So I said, yeah, let me give you the background to that, the historical background, and let me give you some insights into the Hebrew. So I opened my software on my computer and started to go through the Hebrew, started to go through the text and explain it to him. So we're going to start there, some insights from the Hebrew to Jeremiah 29:11. On the one hand, it's a very simple and forthright verse. On the other hand, I'm going to give you a couple little principles that'll help you understand why there have been some differences in your translations. Your Hebrew Jewish questions. Welcome today.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us, friends, on The Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH. Your Hebrew-related questions are warmly welcome today. 866-348-7884. Any Jewish-related questions on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday? So I was opening up in the scriptures for a gentleman I met while flying to Orlando, going through Jeremiah 29:11, well-known verse. Many Christians take it as a promise to them that God's promised them blessing and that his plans are to bless them and not to curse them or hurt them or destroy them. And there is a spiritual application for us as believers, but first and foremost, this was a word to the Jewish exiles. And the false prophets were saying, hey, you're exiled, it's only temporary. I mean, this is really an amazing thought. The false prophets who kept saying Jerusalem won't fall, watch Jerusalem fall. All right, the false prophets who were saying Nebuchadnezzar's not going to triumph, watched him triumph. Now they're in exile with their people, and they're saying, oh, no, we'll be back soon. They still didn't get it. It's a shocking theme in Jeremiah. Even after the prophecies of judgment happen, they still say, well, it's going to change fast. So God's telling the exiles there, settle down. You're going to be there 70 years. 70, yeah. You're going to have kids, grandkids, get married, have families, plant gardens, vineyards, and then after 70 years, I'll bring you back. So Jeremiah 29:11, for I know the plans that I have planned for you, utterance of the Lord, plans of shalom, which means peace, but more broadly, welfare. NIV, at least the older NIV, said prosperity, which is too general and can have too many financial overtones. The newer NIV plans to prosper you, not to harm you. No, it's plans for your welfare. That to me is a much better translation. Plans for your welfare, and not for, the Hebrew is ra'ah, to give you a final end, meaning a future hope. It speaks of a final end and a hope, which together means a future hope. I may come back to one of those key words in a little while, but the word ra'ah is a simple word in Hebrew, ra or ra'ah, and sometimes it's translated evil, and sometimes it's translated disaster. What's the difference? The ESV, plans for welfare and not for evil. King James, thoughts of peace, not of evil. NET, plans to prosper you, not to harm you. NIV, plans to prosper you, not to harm you. New Jewish Version, plans for your welfare, not for disaster. Why do some say evil? Why do some say disaster? It's very simple, and I noticed when I wrote my commentary in Jeremiah that quite a few of the translations got things wrong. Quite a few of the translations missed when it should be disaster, when it should be evil. You say, well, it's the same word. Very, very simple. Are you ready? Very, very simple. The word fundamentally means something bad. That's what it fundamentally means. When I looked at it and thought about it, that was my conclusion. It means fundamentally something bad. When I checked more of the scholarly lexicons and theological studies, they had the same basic conclusion. When people do it, it is evil that they do. When God does it, it is disaster. In other words, a person doing something bad, that is morally bad, that is morally wrong. Because the people of Judah committed ra'ah, committed evil, did wrongly, God was going to bring ra'ah on them. Evil? No. God does not author evil. That's why some translations of Isaiah 45:7 really get this wrong. Yes, God is sovereign, but this is a wrong statement. Isaiah 45:7, for example, King James, I form the light, create darkness, I make peace and create evil. No, not evil. Disaster. God doesn't create evil. It's disaster. In other words, judgment. So when the people commit ra'ah, they are committing bad, evil acts. When God does Ra'ah, he is bringing bad things on people in judgment. Got it? So when you look at translations, you'll often see that they differ on those points. You say, why? Isn't it simple? It is simple. It's actually very, very simple. And it's simply explained. So Isaiah 45:7, which for many is a theological mystery, God creates evil. No, he does not create evil. In him is light, no darkness. Every good and perfect gift comes from him. In him is no darkness, not even the shadow caused by turning. No, he is perfect light, perfect goodness. He is not the author of evil or wickedness. But he does bring judgment, which means bad things on people because of the bad things they do. Now, a human being could commit ra'ah, an act against another person, and that is a bad thing for that other person. But the word itself, when applied to people, has the moral connotation of evil. If you applied it to say, fruit that wasn't ripe, that's bad fruit. We use bad the same way. It doesn't mean it's bad like it's evil. It's bad in terms of not good. And then something bad happened to me, not evil in terms of judgment, but we send and we reap what we sow. We do ra'ah, we reap ra'ah. 866-34-TRUTH. To the phones, Dale in Vienna, Virginia. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Yes, just to say I've really enjoyed listening to you over the month.
Thank you.
Breath of fresh air. Today my question is, can you make a biblical case today for Christians circumcising their babies on the eighth day?
You can make an excellent case for Jewish believers to do it as part of the covenantal agreement that God gave to Abraham. And this is simply an ongoing identification with the people of Israel and saying that we remain part of that people, understanding that it has nothing to do with justification or salvation. I know many Jewish believers that will do this and will celebrate this as an important rite in and with the family, and I see no reason not to do it. In other words, if someone says they don't feel compelled to, that's fine, or they don't have a reason to, that's fine, but I could give absolutely no argument against it. As for someone who's not Jewish doing it, if they simply felt they like the custom, or it's a way of identifying with the Jewish people, that's fine. But I would encourage not in terms of this, in terms of the fact that in 1 Corinthians 7, Paul counsels the Corinthians, if you're saved, circumcised, don't become uncircumcised. In other words, if you're saved as a Jew, don't become a Gentile. If you're saved uncircumcised, don't become circumcised. So if you're saved as a Gentile, don't become a Jew. We have our own identity in Jesus, just like a man doesn't become a woman and a woman doesn't become a man. We have our distinct identities, and yet we are absolutely one and equal in the Messiah, male, female, Jew, Gentile, slave, free. So I think it could be something where a person who is Gentile begins to try to identify with being a Jew or tries to find Jewish blood six generations back as if that makes them special or something like that. I wouldn't tell someone they can't do it or you shouldn't do it, but I would discourage it for Gentile believers and encourage it for Jewish believers while recognizing there's complete, total freedom, and people may have a very different conclusion than I do.
Can I just respond?
Please.
Is that okay? My main interest is health, and I have attended Messianic congregations, even though I am a born-again Gentile, but I don't eat pork or shellfish because, actually, that's not very clean food. Even organic pork is not clean because it just is a very different type of flesh. And there was a book, it's probably out of date, but it's called None of These Diseases by a Dr.
Yep.
McMillan.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually said that blood clotting time in baby boys reaches its zenith on the eighth day. And then recent evidence is coming out saying that in Africa, when they look at rates of HIV transmission in African men, it's much lower among men who have been circumcised.
Mm-hmm.
And also, cervical cancer is lower among women who are married to men who have been circumcised.
Let me just jump in, only because we have a break. I should have probed your question more deeply and asked what's the reason.
Uh-huh.
If you had stated it in terms of health reasons, I'm familiar with the argument about blood clotting best on the eighth day.
Yes.
And although you can't make 100% correlation that all of the food laws had dietary implications, many certainly do. But for a Christian to say, hey, I believe God had wisdom in that for health reasons, and because of that, I feel it's the best thing to do. Oh, by all means, 100%, no questions asked.
Yeah.
My answer was in terms of a Jewish identification. But in terms of the health question and your reason for it, 100%, I wouldn't have any hesitation whatsoever or reason to argue against that. All right, we'll be back with your Hebrew-related questions, and I've got a really neat announcement. Oh, I'm serious, a really neat announcement to make to you.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. 866-34-TRUTH with your Hebrew and Jewish-related questions. Let me take some from our Ask Dr. Brown page on our Facebook page from John. What does the term Hebrew mean? It's actually a complex question, but then one easily answered. The easy side is this became a name by which the people of Israel were identified. They were called Hebrews. Abram is first called a Hebrew. Jonah is identified by outsiders as a Hebrew. Some suggested it was a way that the people were identified from the outside. It became a name for the people of Israel as a whole. So any Israelite living in the north or south, be it the kingdom of Israel, kingdom of Judah, as they divide it, would still be considered a Hebrew ultimately. And Paul could speak of himself as a Hebrew of the Hebrews in the New Testament. And although we commonly identify as Jews, I am a Hebrew as well, talking about lineally a Hebrew as well, not a spiritual application here, but just in terms of blood, heritage. Now, what does the term actually mean? There's debate. Does it have to do with crossing over? There's one view from Ever and crossing over the Ivri. There's another view that associates the Hebrews with a class of people that were variously identified as Chapiro or Chaburo, in Babylonian and Assyrian sources. And there's debate, a certain group of people identified a certain way that doesn't fully answer the question. So even though you'll commonly hear a Hebrew is one who passed over and had to do with passing over in Promised Land and so on, there is actually no clear evidence for this. Even when the Hebrew Bible uses a play on words, it's not telling us an absolute definite origin or fact. So we do not know for sure the origin of the meaning of the word. There are a few different options. However, we know it comes to mean and refer to the people of Israel as a whole, the Hebrew people. And, of course, the language that's spoken is then called Hebrew from that. In other words, the Hebrew language didn't come first as far as an identification. It was the language that was spoken by these people who were called Hebrew. Hence, it is the Hebrew language. Fred is wondering, can I explain the cultural nuances that may not be clear to the Western mind in the story of the prodigal son? Fred, I'm sure they're there, but I'm going to have to chew on that a little bit. Most of it seems self-evident and obvious as we read it, that the genius of Yeshua's parables is that scholars can study them for centuries and you can and get new insights, and you can share them with a child, and a child learns the application. Most things seem self-evident as I look at the text, but let me chew on that and see if there are specific Jewish background culture nuances that give really new insights into the text. Cynthia, is it true that a new high priest has been selected and priests are currently being trained to serve in the new temple? It's going to be incredible undertaking to build the temple with the current climate in the Middle East. Joel Richardson, when he was on with us, suggested that if there was an Islamic Antichrist, that could be something he could broker with the Jewish people that, okay, you get to rebuild the temple here, and we'll make that conciliation to you as part of course, a demonic strategy. Otherwise, how in the world is a temple going to rebuild there where you've got the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque? I have no earthly solution as to how that would happen. So if there is a temple that's going to be built, things are going to look very different than they look right now. Is it true that a new high priest has been selected? Priests are currently being trained to serve in the new temple. There is a movement of some religious Jews in Israel, unknown to the great majority of Jews, I would say, in Israel, and not a concern to even many religious Jews in Israel. There is a group that trains regularly. They have classes. They study the relevant texts. They have been raising funds to build many of the temple items and the outfits for the priests and things like that, which is absolutely fascinating that this is happening. And they do have priest training as to a universally recognized high priest, that the Jewish people would say, we recognize that this would be the high priest if a temple were rebuilt. I do not believe there's any type of recognition of that. But has that been chosen internally along with priests? There'd be no reason why these people would not have all of that in place. But again, the great majority of people in Israel don't even know anything about this. Okay, about to go back to the phones, but I want to make a really neat announcement to you. You remember a few weeks ago I had Scott Lindsay from Logos Bible Software on the air with me to talk about the program, to talk about the software, what was available. And they did something very, very unique. They extended a 15% discount on all of their base packages. And the base packages are phenomenal. And they range from a couple hundred dollars to, $1,500 or something like that. Just kind of amazing. And you get, $20,000 of material for it. Anyway, they did something very unique, 15% discount on all base packages, plus any order, whether you ordered one book from them out of their 27,000 or a package, Line of Fire would receive a 15% donation. Well, it was so successful, so many of you responded, that they extended this, that they said, okay, we'll continue to donate 15% from any order that comes into Logos. We will donate that to you as long as it goes through the Line of Fire site that we'll give you, or it's mentioned to our phone folks. Well, they just told me that they're extending indefinitely the 15% discount on the base packages too. So jot this down and go there at your earliest opportunity. Logos, that's L-O-G-O-S, logos.com/lineoffire. All right? Logos, L-O-G-O-S, logos.com/lineoffire. When you click that in, you'll go to a site that specially introduces you to the packages, 15% discounts. You've got to use the coupon, the Line of Fire coupon. Or you can call, jot this down, 1-800-875-6467. 1-800-875-6467. And then mention Line of Fire when you do, and you'll get the 15% base discount on the base packages, and then any other stuff you order, any other books, you can get my Jewish Objections books and Go and Sin No More, we're going to have available there in the future. Any of those that you order, all right, will get a 15% discount. Do you realize what that means? That as thousands of dollars of orders come in, you get this software that's going to dig you deeper and deeper in the Word, and the click of a mouse, you'll have insights that you might not have been able to get in 20 years because you wouldn't have known where the tools were or how to access it. Right there at your fingertips, if you're preaching, teaching, studying the Word, I'm encouraging you to dive in deeper, okay? I just got now the a whole package, a scholar's package I never had before with Logos, and I'm flying to India tomorrow. I can't wait to be digging into this as I fly. I'm going to have a massive library that would fill the plane at my fingertips, but you get to bless us. This is money that comes in so that we can reach more and more people and we can pour into our missionaries around the world. So take advantage of that, all right? Call this number, 1-800-875-6467. Mention the Line of Fire. Or go to logos.com/lineoffire. All right, I got a ton more questions to answer, insights to give you from the Hebrew, questions to take, whole lot more to come. Those that were leaving us now, oh, have a great day anyway.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, 866-34-TRUTH. Any Hebrew question you have, Jewish-related question, today is the day to ask. All right, Ron in Silver Spring, Maryland, thanks for calling The Line of Fire.
Thank you, Dr. Brown. I have a question comment. Is the Jewish people favored with God among everybody else? And I understand the covenant between Abraham and Isaac. And because it seems throughout history, they always seem to, I guess, defy God and not get it. And even when Jesus came, they still didn't believe who he was. And I always wonder, what does it take for them to really get, you know, to really get it? I think they're so rooted in their custom that they're missing the whole picture. And that's my comment.
Yeah, Ron, it's a great question. There is no favoritism in God. However, certain people are selected for certain purposes, or a people group selected for a purpose. And then there's more accountability, more potential for blessing, more potential for judgment. So God was looking on the earth for someone that would hear his voice and to whom he could reveal himself, someone who would guide his children in the right way after him so that there could be something passed on to the generation. So God found Abraham, and he was pleasing to the Lord, just like Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. I mean, he was pleasing to the Lord. The same with Abram. He heard the voice of God. He obeyed. He believed the Lord. Genesis 15, Genesis 18, God said that he is going to guide his children after him in a right way. Genesis 26, he kept all the teachings and commandments of the Lord. So Abraham found favor in God's sight, and God made a promise to Abraham based on that. It was a one-way promise, meaning even if individuals within the nation sinned, God would still keep his end of the bargain. And we're told in Romans chapter 11, verse 28, that even though Jewish people may be opposing the gospel, and in that sense enemies, they are still loved on account of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Amos, the third chapter, the first verse, God says of Israel, "You only have I known," meaning selected, chosen out of all the nations of the earth. "Therefore, I will punish you for your iniquities." So the Jewish people, in that sense, were singled out to reveal God to the world, entrusted with the teaching of the Lord and a revelation of the one true God that no other nation in the ancient world had. And because of that, greater accountability. So through history, my Jewish people have been terribly decimated by judgment. I pointed out the other day that while there are over 1 billion Indians in the world, well over 1 billion, and well over 1 billion Chinese in the world, there are about 14 million Jews, whereas our history is as ancient. We're both ancient peoples with histories over 3,000 years old. So it's not favoritism. It's being selected for a purpose and therefore singled out. So there's great potential for blessing, and there's great potential for judgment. And even though through the Jewish people, through the Messiah and the prophets and the apostles, the knowledge of God has come to the whole world, also Jewish people, we've been terribly judged and decimated, and as a national people, more hated and despised and persecuted than any other people on the earth. So if it's favoritism, it's an odd kind of favoritism, like the old Jewish saying goes, why not choose someone else? That being said, a religious Jew considers it a great privilege to have been given this responsibility. And what's it going to take? There remains a remnant by grace. And I believe as the church provokes Israel to envy, as increasingly difficult times come for the Jewish people, as a strong Jewish believing witness rises in the midst of the Jewish people, that more and more Jews will come to faith and we will see a national turning. Hey, Ron, thank you for an important question. Back with your questions and more insights from the scriptures when we return.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us today on The Line of Fire broadcast. 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Opening up the Hebrew Scriptures, answering your Hebrew and Jewish-related questions today. One question I just spotted, where is this, from Anthony on the Ask Dr. Brown page. Do you know any verse where understanding Hebrew idioms helps in translating the verses? Certainly all the time. And Bible translators are normally aware of these things, quite aware of them, and that affects the translation. But there's always debate about these things, how a given verse should be translated. But I was commenting earlier on the program about a simple, straightforward verse, Jeremiah 29:11. I was explaining how the word shalom does not mean prosper there, prosperity. And it means more than just peace. It's really welfare, plans for your shalom, your welfare, your well-being, reestablished peacefully back in your homeland. But it says at the end, plans to give you literally an end and a hope. An end and a hope. What does that mean? Well, I'm not going to get in depth right now about the word there for end, because it's a tremendously important word, one that I've taught on extensively over the years, the word acharit, which in a moral context speaks of the final end of righteousness and the final end of sin, the final consequences of sin and righteousness. But what does it mean, I'll give you an end and a hope? What does that mean? The end can refer to future, meaning you'll have a future. I'll give you a future and a hope. But there is something called hendiadys in Hebrew. Maybe you've run across the word and thought it was a flower or something like that. H-E-N-D-I-A-D-Y-S, hendiadys. And what it is you take this word and this word, and you come up with one concept. This plus this equals this concept. This noun plus this noun equals this concept. So I will give you a future and a hope means I will give you a future hope. And that is the way some translations render it. Now, I'm just going to survey this. My guess, just a guess, would be that translations like the New American Standard or the King James would not translate it like that. It would be a bit more literal, and that perhaps a Jewish translation would render it the way I suggested. Now, let's take a look. The King James, to give you an expected end. An expected end. That to me does not fully convey what it says, but it recognized the nuance of the Hebrew there. All right. The New American Standard, I'll give you a future and a hope. All right. A future and a hope. NLT, bit of a paraphrase, I would have expected better here, to give you a future and a hope. The New Jewish Version, to give you a hopeful future. See, that's the way I would take that. So that's just a particular Hebrew use. It's not a big deal, the difference between I'll give you a future and a hope and a hopeful future, all right? But I would rather render it like that. Yeah, there are many, many such examples in the Scriptures. 866-34-TRUTH. Back to the phones. Stephen in Manhattan, thanks for calling The Line of Fire.
Hi, Michael. God bless you and your program. It's wonderful. I just wanted to mention about my favorite of the Old and New Testament covenant, very fascinating personality, Jewish personality. My favorite is and always will remain Paul, formerly Saul. And I don't think God makes any choices without really thinking about them. And he chose this person who was, of course, an incredible zealot, even though he was persecuting Christians. There was something in his personality, in his intellect, in his courage, in his makeup. I really believe this. I don't know if you, but this is why I'm asking you. I think that the success of Christianity owes a lot to him. A lot to him. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. Let's think about this. On the one hand, the gospel is simple, and Paul himself said he didn't try to impress people with his rhetoric, and he spoke of the foolishness of preaching. On the flip side, there's no question that God chose a brilliant thinker. In my book, The Real Kosher Jesus, I refer to him as the Jewish genius who took the gospel to the nations. So for sure, God raised someone up with brilliance. God raises others up with simplicity. The key thing is that we have a real, genuine faith. In that sense, we're childlike. But Paul says to the Corinthians, when it comes to evil, be children, be innocent. But in your understanding, be adults. So Saul, Paul absolutely played a key role. When I was reading Romans year or two ago, I've been in Romans, of course, since then, but when I was reading it, going through some passages, I was struck by the amazing insights that Paul got when he only had the Hebrew Scriptures, the Old Testament. In other words, he didn't have the New Testament written. He didn't have systematic theology textbooks. He didn't have any of this stuff. All he had was the Hebrew Scriptures, and yet, having the Hebrew Scriptures, he got these amazing insights in terms of the plan of redemption and these amazing insights in terms of God's plan to incorporate the Gentiles into the family of God, and how the Messianic age had broken in already, and they didn't have to wait for some future age for the Gentiles to be fellow partakers. Now, one thing that's commonly misunderstood about Paul is that he used to be Saul and he became Paul, that he was a Jew who was persecuting Christians, and then he got saved and he became a Christian and changed his name from Saul to Paul. In reality, Saul the Jew was persecuting fellow Jews who believed that Jesus Yeshua was the Messiah. He had an encounter with Yeshua.
Very true.
And
he
became a follower of Messiah, but he did not become a Christian because there was no such thing as a Christian, I'm saying at that moment when he became a believer.
Yes.
And because he was a Jew who was born in a Greek city, Tarsus, in all likelihood, he had at least two names from birth, Shaul, his Hebrew name, and Paulos, his Greek name. Some even would suggest he would have had a Latin name as well. But after Acts 9, when he is now Shaul, Saul, the follower of Yeshua, he's still called Saul. The beginning of Acts 13, he's still called Saul. It mentions Barnabas and Saul. And then when he begins his mission to the Gentiles, he's called Paul because Paul was the name that he would use in the Greek-speaking world.
Right, yeah. Well, Michael, so, to finish up by one thing, though, and, in my heart, how I feel that these born-again Jews, or say born-again Christians, born-again Jews make incredible Christians, and that born-again Christians are honorary Jews, if you think about it.
If you want to
part of the clan, you know what I mean? Like you
right,
said,
part of the clan.
You know.
Yeah, and let me just jump in. Part of the clan, and if you want to say honorary, I can accept that concept as well. The reason often that Jewish believers make a certain mark that others may not make, it would be the same with Muslim believers and others. When you have to go against the grain, when there is a greater price to pay, when you are challenged about what you believe and have to dig deeper, it often means there's a deeper conversion of heart and life and a deeper perseverance to break through. But the fact of the matter is, when you look at people God is using around the world, the vast majority in the body are not Jews, just numerically. So God has this incredible orchestration of his wisdom, of his power coming through frail human beings, all of us, like worms outside of his grace, but empowered by God to do impossible things. Always a pleasure chatting with you, our friend Stephen from Manhattan. Let me go back to some internet questions here again on our Ask Dr. Brown Facebook page. Devin, why was the book of Hebrews written in Greek? Because Greek was the primary language that was used by Jews in the diaspora. Jews spread out throughout the Greek world would know Greek better than they know Hebrew. You said, but they were Jews. All right, Look at Jews living outside of Israel today around the world. Jews living in America. What language do we speak? We speak English in America. If we live in Russia, we'd speak Russian. If we lived in South America, we'd speak Spanish. So that's just the way it was. Written in Greek and quoting from the Septuagint. Quoting from the Greek Bible. You say, well, why didn't they quote from the Hebrew scriptures and make their own translation? Because the readers would have the Greek. The readers would have the Greek. So when they're looking up a verse, that's where they'd be looking it up in the Septuagint. The goal is to get the message to the maximum number of people in the most effective way. That's the goal. All right, back with more. Stay with us.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on the Line of Fire today, Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Let me take a moment as we've been talking about Hebrew insights, opening up questions from Scripture. These are all weighty issues because it's the truth of God's Word, but we haven't been talking about real heavy subjects, and I'm sure you're glad to take a break from heavy subjects, as we all are. I want to mention, though, as we look at Israel in the Middle East, and we look at the potential threats against the Jewish people and Islamic terrorism and the like, I just want to mention that the ones who are suffering most because of radical Islam are Muslims. The ones who are suffering most in the Middle East and are most frequently the victims of violence are Muslims. Or if you say you go to a country like Pakistan, the Muslim women's who have had Muslim women's. There's actually a reason I said women's. I'm serious. I'll tell you that in a minute. I'm serious. I'm not making an excuse for my mistake. I'll tell you why in a second. But in all seriousness, Muslim women in, say, a country like Pakistan or Iran, who've had acid thrown on their face by Muslim men because they refused to marry them. I mean, this happens far more than we'd ever dream. The ones, say, in Afghanistan, the women who can't receive an education. The people suffering most from radical Islam are other Muslims. So in case you didn't hear, in Egypt, a terrorist killed at least 16 Egyptian policemen and wounded 7 in an assault on a police station at the border between Egypt and Israel on Sunday. You may not have even heard that much in the news. They then seized 2 military vehicles attempted to storm the border with the Jewish state. Israel said its aircraft fired on one of the commandeered vehicles and the other exploded at the border crossing. 500 kilos of explosives were meant for Israelis. Not fence, one of the vehicles used in the terrorist attack Sunday night near a border common to Egypt, Israel, and Gaza was loaded with ammunition. It exploded at the border crossing into Israel. The second vehicle was able to penetrate Israel. Anyway, just to say that we see that the terrorist attack, the plan to bring explosives into Egypt, into Israel, failed. But there were at least 16 Egyptian policemen killed, 7 wounded. According to the reports I have in front of me, Al-Qaeda-linked gangs, Bedouin terrorists, and drug smugglers and fanatical Islamist groups from the Gaza Strip have turned the Sinai Desert into a jihad nest, particularly since the latter stages of the Mubarak regime. Who does that hurt most? That's hurting Arabs, Muslims most. All right? Yes, Israelis, Jews are constantly under threat, for sure. But I'm just making that comment. We need to constantly be praying for God's mercy to be poured out in the Muslim world. All right. Now, why did I say women's? Why did I, who at least should know English, say women's? I'm going to tell you why. This is not a cop-out. There was a question I was just asked by Robert on the Ask Dr. Brown page. Is the Hebrew word for woman in a regular plural, like the word sheep, one sheep, two sheep? And the answer is no. Like in English, we have woman, woman, and women. In Hebrew, you have isha, which is woman, singular, nashim, women, plural. So it's not like women, women's in Hebrew. So that's what was actually in my mind, that they're two different words, and somehow it morphed together in my brain and came out incorrectly. All right, let's just see here. Justin, will we still celebrate the Feast of the Lord in heaven? Possible, but why say would there be a Day of Atonement in heaven? These things which foreshadow the Messiah, and ultimately Feast of Trumpets, which in Jewish tradition becomes Jewish New Year, Day of Atonement, and Sukkot Tabernacles, are all speaking of events that have not yet happened in terms of their prophetic significance, the Messiah's return with the sound of the trumpet, national atonement for Israel, ingathering of the nations. Now, will they be celebrated on the earth during the millennial kingdom? As we understand, the thousand-year reign of the Messiah on the earth, Jesus ruling and reigning from Jerusalem, the knowledge of the glory of the Lord filling the earth as the waters cover the seas. Will the feast be celebrated then? Zechariah 14 would say yes. Zechariah 14 would say absolutely yes, that the nations will come to Jerusalem to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. Absolutely. So that there could be remembrance for these days. If Ezekiel 40 through 48 is a future vision about a future temple, for various reasons, then that would suggest, yes, these would be celebrated. The eternal age in heaven, I would think not. But the Bible does actually not address that specifically. All right, if you're on hold, stay with us. I will keep taking calls in the next hour. David from Greenwich, Connecticut called in. But couldn't get on the air with us. Does a born-again believer have to obey the Torah? Answer is, in particular, speaking to all believers, Gentile believers, does a born-again believer have to obey the Torah? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Born-again believer, a Gentile believer in particular, is not required by God to obey the dietary laws. Is not required by God to go through ritual purity immersions. Is not required by God. Say a man with a brother, a married man, he's got a brother, brother's married, their brother dies without having children. Is he required to then take that man's wife and have a second wife and have children through that woman for the man? Obviously not. Now, if you differ with me, we'll take that up one day. If you'd like to make your case that all believers are required by God to observe the Torah, by all means, we will have that discussion. But not the closing minute of the broadcast today. All right. If you want to get on right now, and we'll take your questions in the next hour, 866-34-TRUTH. Hey, please pray for me. We've got a special broadcast we'll be airing tomorrow. In fact, I'll be preparing it tonight. So I think you'll really enjoy tomorrow's broadcast. Is being prepared in advance because I'll be in the beginning of my journey to India. I arrive at my destination, God willing, about 36 hours after I leave the States. So stateside time, I'll be leaving here mid-afternoon on Friday and arriving at my destination early morning Sunday in India, final destination. So please be praying for grace on the trip, for anointing. I'm going there to celebrate a very special time, 60th birthday for my dear friend Yesu Padam. And people coming from around the nation to honor him. And I'll be ministering to leaders and pastors that come there for a couple days. But pray for grace. And would you stand with us and help us? We could use some extra help on this trip. And we're going to have, I believe, a significant time to touch many lives. Give us a call, 1-800-278-9978, 1-800-278-9978. Or just go to AskDrBrown.org and click on donate. And we so appreciate that. It means a lot. And hold my hands up in prayer as we travel. And God willing, next week we're broadcasting live from India, which is always special. My bottom line today, I feel God inviting us through his word to dig deeper, to study more, to explore the riches and treasures that are hidden there, and then to be determined to be doers of the word and not hearers only. What Christians call the Old Testament, scholars call the Hebrew Scriptures. We'll be giving you insights from the Hebrew of the Hebrew Scriptures today.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us today on The Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. You've got Jewish questions. We've got Jewish answers today. We're giving you some insights from the Hebrew Bible. We are doing our best to answer as many questions as possible. So give us a call, 866-348-7884, or you can post your question on my Facebook page, Ask Dr. Brown, A-S-K-D-R Brown. One word on Facebook. In fact, I'm going to stay on Facebook for a little while here and scroll down and answer a few more questions here. Tom, there's no Hebrew word for everlasting or forever, everlasting punishment, etc., which is more of a modern conception. Olam is the closest, right? There's no Hebrew word for hell. The Hebrews didn't believe in hell, which was Egyptian. There's no Hebrew for slave. It's a servant, right? Going back to the original Hebrew changes the meaning of a lot of doctrine. Actually, Tom, I don't accept everything that's written there. For example, the word eved means slave more than it means servant. Now, it comes from root meaning to serve, but it certainly did not mean servant. You didn't have a Hebrew servant, like someone is your servant at your house. It meant slave more than servant. Now, what happened was there was the perverted slave trade that continues in many parts of the world today, which has nothing to do with the intention of the word. But eved means slave more than it means servant. As for no concept for everlasting, of course there are concepts for everlasting. For example, olam ve'olam, everlasting, or le'olam va'ed, for everlasting, forever and ever. There are ways to say forever and ever in Hebrew. And when it speaks of God being me'olam ad olam, from everlasting to everlasting, it doesn't just mean from a distant point to a distant point. So the word does not always mean everlasting. Sometimes it can mean for the foreseeable future or to a distant point, but it certainly can mean everlasting. There's no question about that. As for no Hebrew word for hell, where do you think we get Gehenna from? Gehinom in Hebrew. So by the time of Jesus, there absolutely was a concept of hell, and Jews did believe in it. So some overstatements there. Jerry, 613 laws, oral or written. These are the ones Jesus said he did not come to abolish in Matthew 5:17. The concept of 613 commandments refers to the number you can deduce from the five books of Moses. And this is something that the Talmud mentions once, and then literature in the Middle Ages, they began to develop, okay, which are the exact 613 commandments. And there has been some debate, even in the religious Jewish community over the years, as to exactly what constitutes the 613. So general agreement on almost all, but a few, there's a debate. Does it mean this? Does it mean this? Because it's hard to number. Is this one command, these two different ones? Are these overlapping? Are these distinct? When Jesus said he didn't come to abolish Law of the Prophets, notice he didn't just say law, but Law of the Prophets, meaning the Hebrew Scriptures. He's not going to abolish. He was going to bring them to fulfillment, that which they were pointing to. So he was referring to the five books of Moses and the prophets. He's referring to the whole of the Old Testament, what we would call the Old Testament. He was not referring to oral traditions. So the question, was he referring to the 613 laws? I don't think that concept existed in the first century. There's no evidence that it did. But the whole of the Torah, sure, that's what he was talking about. So he does not abolish but fulfill. He brings that which is promised and spoken of and required to its fullest meaning and application. All right, back with your phone calls and many more questions on the other side of the break, which is going to be over before you know it. Don't go anywhere.
God of light, hear our cry, send the fire.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us, friends, on The Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Please remember to be in prayer for me as you're listening to the show tomorrow. It'll be a specially pre-recorded show. We often try our hardest, the rare times we have to do that, to make those shows specially valuable to you, the listeners. So by all means, listen, but please pray. Remember to pray for me during the broadcast. I'll be just at the beginning of my journey to India, and God willing, arriving our time early Sunday morning, about 36 hours or so of travel and stops there before we arrive, and then some important ministry as we join together for a special celebration honoring my dear colleague Yesu Pattan there on his 60th birthday. It's a miracle he lived to be 10, should have died of malnutrition, was picked up on the side of the road by a Canadian missionary, dying of malnutrition as an untouchable, should have been dead as a radical communist, probably terrorist would be the best word to put on it, should have been dead and could have been killed a number of times for preaching the gospel, but here he is at 60, and pastors and leaders will come from around the country, and I'll be able to have some wonderful time ministering to ministers and leaders from India, and church planters, while there. So thank you for praying. Boy, a ton of questions I want to get to on the Ask Dr. Brown Facebook page, but first to the phones. Our buddy Yehuda from Columbus, Ohio. How you doing, man?
Pretty good. How about you, Dr. Brown?
Good. Remember, I don't get too many calls from Yehudas in Columbus, Ohio, so stuck with me.
You know what's good?
Yes, how you doing?
I'm good. I've been having a lot of conversations with Ryan lately, so going at
great.
It.
Yeah, well, I get all the emails. For those who don't know the Ryan we're talking about, one of our team members, Ryan, based in Atlanta, answers many of the Jewish-related questions that come our way, and then he blind copies me on all of his answers, so I get to look at what's going on and who's being interacted with. Yeah, so I haven't read every word of the conversation, but I know you guys have been interacting a lot, and you're obviously very serious in your studies here, so how can I help you today?
I wanted to investigate more with the new covenant of Jeremiah 31, 30-34, and as it relates in Hebrews, and also as it relates to the Gentiles. Part of the reason why this is kind of a sensitive issue is I was looking at, I just do like random research sometimes on like what people think of Judaism and whatnot, and you know, David Duke, you know, prominent anti-Jewish personality, he wrote something in his I think it was called like Jewish Supremacy, My Awakening, something rather. And he quotes from the book of Hebrews, but context, you know, like within context of the Jeremiah 31. And he essentially interprets it in a way saying the Jews don't have a covenant anymore with God because they broke it. He focuses on the part where it says, you know, like basically that we broke the covenant. And I don't know, I'm just like confused because I sort of see that way how Paul interprets that in the final, when he says in verse 18, he says, by making this covenant new, he makes the first one obsolete, which means that it's going to disappear. And when I read this covenant, ironically, I have the exact opposite view because it says that the covenant will be not like the covenant that I formed with their forefathers the day I took them by the hand to take them out of the land of Egypt, that they broke my covenant, although I was the Lord's son, says the Lord. And says, this is the covenant I will form with the house of Israel. And it's clearly referring to a group of people that were previously under the Mosaic covenant.
Right.
Because those are the people who are in Egypt. So I don't understand how this covenant can be with the Gentiles at all. I'm not saying that Gentiles aren't,
I'll gladly explain to you. Number one, you probably are not going to get a lot of theological insights from the former Grand Wizard of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. And I might as well quote some Orthodox Jewish rabbi who has said that Jews have a soul and Gentiles don't. They have an animal soul. I mean, you get all kinds of crazy views that are out there. And by the way, that's an actual comment that someone
wrote
recently.
I've heard it all.
right. So you're always going to get strange comments and wrong interpretations.
Right.
Of course, we don't know who you made reference to. Paul. We certainly don't know who wrote Hebrews. It could have been Paul.
Writer Hebrews. Yeah.
Right. It's unlikely, but Hebrews is not saying anything different than Jeremiah says. It's talking about the covenant. It's not talking about different people. Remember, he's writing to Jews. The writer of Hebrews is writing to Jews and explaining that this new covenant to the house of Israel and Judah that God promised has been implemented, and that there's no change of the people. There's a change in the nature of the covenant. There's a change in the internalizing of the covenant. Will it have the same laws or not? That's something that's fair to debate, because God simply says that he'll put his teachings, his Torah in his people's hearts. And Torah can mean five books of Moses. Torah can mean the whole of the Old Testament. Torah can mean simply teaching. Like in Proverbs 3, my son, don't forsake my Torah, don't forsake my teaching. So we don't know exactly, based on that, what the content will be, but we know the nature of the covenant will be different, and that the Sinai covenant was such where God gave the commands and the people fell short. They broke the covenant. Does God cast off our people? Does he cast off the Jewish people? No, because of his covenant faithfulness to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He says, I'm going to make a new and better covenant. All right? So it's a new and better covenant.
Specifically with Israel. Where do we get the idea? I'm trying to derive where it says in Jeremiah 31:33-34, that this covenant, if the Jews reject it, will be replaced and given to the Gentiles. That's sort of what I'm trying to derive.
Well, I don't believe that this has anything to do with Jewish rejection of a covenant that it now goes to the Gentiles. I don't see the text saying that, and Hebrews doesn't even hint at that in the least. Hebrews is not even addressing the question of the Gentiles. What you have to look at is the role of the Jewish people in the promises of God. Throughout Jeremiah, Israel's salvation, or the salvation of Jewish people, or the restoration of Jewish people to right relationship with God, brings the knowledge of God to the nations. That's a frequent theme that we have with the prophets.
Agreed.
All right, so as Israel is blessed, Israel is to be a blessing to the entire world. Through Israel now, the things that have been given to the Jewish people are now not their exclusive treasure. We have clear passages in the book of Isaiah where even foreigners, it's the most logical reading of the text, serve as priests. How does that happen? Where the foreigner has the equal standing with the Israelite. You look at Isaiah 19, for example. I'm just looking at general passages. You may say, well, these haven't happened yet. That's not even my argument. I'm looking at the larger concept. Isaiah 19, where Israel is the third part, together with Assyria and Egypt, all as worshipers of Yahweh. So Israel's restoration means the salvation of the world. Israel's restoration, Paul talks about it in Romans, the 11th chapter, will be life from the dead for the entire world. So as God establishes the new covenant with the people of Israel through the Messiah, and now comes and brings forgiveness of sins to us and puts his laws and teachings within our heart, now we proclaim the Messiah to the world, and those benefits go to the entire world. It's just the way it's always been planned by God. And just as God gave his covenant to Israel, his Sinai covenant with ideals and goals, and these are gradually realized over a period of time, it's the same with the new covenant. One other thing that's a really important principle, let me ask you this. Have you studied Jeremiah carefully?
I'm more concerned with what he's saying concerning I understand that he's like, you know, his prophet during the time of the destruction, like right before the destruction and of the first temple, and then he lived through the exile and he was taken as a prisoner. And I understand the general gist of it, but I'm not like 100% like, you know, I couldn't like recite, you know, everything from it.
Got it. Okay. Well, I appreciate you hedging things there. So you don't set yourself up for the kill here. All right. So, cause it's not a trick question, but all of the prophecies about the return from exile, that the Jewish people are going to return, almost every one of them, and there's going to be a glorious restoration. and the Messiah will be revealed, the branch as he's called, and there'll be peace and safety, and they'll all worship the Lord with one heart and one soul. And this is what's supposed to happen. Ezekiel prophesies the same thing. Isaiah prophesies the same
right.
thing. But the fact is,
so
the exiles came back.
It's also in Deuteronomy, the
right,
chapter
right, but,
30.
But, yeah. Right, but here
it
specifically,
after
it's in the... It's
these, a, after we're gathered in from the exiles, then he will give us, circumcise our heart. And that's the way...
Right,
I
all these amazing things. Right, the problem is, and we'll stay through this on this through the break, Yehuda. The problem is, the exiles did return, the temple was rebuilt, but not with the expected glory. In other words, the promises happen, but only in part, not with the expected number, glory, results. How does that tie in with the Messiah? Exact same principle. Well, this is a big one. It's important. We'll continue our conversation with Yehuda.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us on the Line of Fire broadcast today, 866-34-TRUTH. Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, we're taking your thoroughly Jewish questions. The matter I'm discussing with Yehuda in Columbus, a Jewish man, living as a Jewish man, seeking truth. We've dialogued before, that's why I know these things. Not a believer in Jesus Yeshua, but with some very good questions. So we're continuing a dialogue we started some weeks back on the air. And I pointed out something I mentioned in my Jeremiah commentary, something I mentioned in Volume 4 of my series, Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus, that the promises of the return from exile were almost all exceptionally glorious. Massive numbers, highway in the desert, return to the land, established in the land, temple rebuilt, the implication never to be destroyed again, the nation having a circumcised heart, all to follow the Lord. It didn't happen like that. Well, part of it happened, but a lot didn't. It's the exact same thing with the Messiah. The Messiah did come when he had to come, which is during the days of the Second Temple. I mean, the prophets made that clear. He did come when he had to come. He did what he had to do to inaugurate his mission and to fulfill the first part of it. But the other parts, universal peace on earth, that hasn't happened yet. Just as the prophecies of the return from exile have happened in part, but not in full. All right, Yehuda, you've been listening, I'm sure, carefully to all of that. Do you understand the larger point that I'm making in terms of the parallels there? What's your thought on that?
I'm in disagreement with you about the fact that the Messiah had to come before the destruction of the Second Temple. I'm not really seeing that just based off of, I think most clearly I can see that in where I know Hosea was a prophet, you know, during, right before the or like during the exiles. With
hang on just one second. Forgive me for interrupting, but I want to focus on this part.
Yeah.
Let's just talk about the prophecies of the return from exile.
Yeah.
The prophets said,
That is a prophecy about the return from exile.
Okay. Let's just so
Hosea 3:4, where he speaks of...
Right. But hang on. Here's my question for you, just so we can be focused and do our best to make headway, all right? Because that's what we both want, to make headway in our discussion. Let's say the prophet said there will be a return from exile in which numbers 1 through 10 will happen. And 1 through 5 absolutely happened, unmistakably. And 6 through 10... did not happen, unmistakably. How do you understand that?
You can understand it from the context of we are under the, you know, covenant with God that if we do, you know, under the Mosaic covenant, if we perform the mitzvot, you know, during the first exile, we obviously merited the ability to build a second temple off of our, you know, mitzvot,
Where does it say that again, basically?
What?
All right, but the prophet said this will happen, correct?
Mm-hmm. And yeah,
it only happened in part.
A rebuilding
it didn't say if you're worthy. this will happen. In fact, Ezekiel 36 explicitly said, you're not worthy. You haven't repented. You're still unclean and you're exiled, but my name is being blasphemed, because of which I have to bring you, I have to bring you back. All right. Mm-hmm. None of the, no one ever said they were worthy. There's not a word ever in the Hebrew scriptures that said when the Jewish people returned and rebuilt the temple, they did so because they're worthy. Not a syllable.
Zerubbabel was called a servant of God when he was, he said, I have chosen you, and the signet has been re-given. So obviously,
where
there
does
was
it say,
there was
where
repentance
does it,
done.
Where does it say they were worthy to build the temple? Just give me one syllable of one verse that says that the Jewish people rebuilt the temple because they were worthy through the keeping of the commandments.
I would say through the fact that I just said, the signet ring, because before, with Jehoiakim, you had the signet ring taken away, with, and that's a symbolism of you sinned. But the signet ring was given.
Where does it say that the nation, where does it say one syllable? I mean, you're pressing points with me that I think we've answered you. I think Ryan has answered your points systematically and clearly, and you'll come back with a question as if you didn't, you didn't take in the answers. That's what troubles me a bit. In other words, you have the questions, but when you get information that gives you an answer, rather than hearing that, you come up with a counter argument. So let's press this one more time. One verse anywhere in the Hebrew Bible. Zerubbabel was one person, okay? And even there, it doesn't mention his specific repentance. The only repentance that's hinted at is that of Jehoiachin at the end of Jeremiah 52 and then there in Haggai 2. One verse anywhere that says they rebuilt the temple because they were worthy as a nation through the keeping of the commandments. One verse. One part of a verse. One word. It's not there.
If you don't, you know, we're in disagreement. I mean, I'll stand by what I originally said. I really see that as a signification of the fact that people came back together as a remnant.
Tell you what. You want to build an entire edifice on a thread that doesn't even exist. I give you all the prophecies of the return from exile, of Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Isaiah, all of which said something far greater would happen than happened. The explanation is simple. It's a very simple explanation. They prophesied of things to come which had a partial fulfillment at that time, and the rest awaits a future fulfillment. It is the exact same thing with the Messiah. The Messiah was prophesied to come during that time. Haggai 2 says the glory of the second temple would be greater than the glory of the first. Malachi 3 says the Lord himself would visit that second temple. Daniel 9 tells us that atonement for sin and everlasting righteousness had to be established before the second temple was destroyed. There's only one explanation. It's very simple. Messiah had to come. Messiah was part of the promise of the return from exile and the rebuilding of the second temple. Did he come when he had to come? Yes. Did the exiles return after 7 years as was prophesied? Yes. Did he come with the expected glory? Did the exiles come with the fully expected glory? No. There was the return with glory in part. There was the becoming of the Messiah with glory in part. There was the fulfilling of the first part of the promises. That's how we know the rest will happen. We know the prophets are true prophets because they prophesied 1 through 10 would happen. 1 through 5 happened. Now 6 through 10 will happen. The same way with the Messiah. They prophesied his death, his resurrection, and the bringing of the glory to that first temple. It happened. They prophesied the nation would reject him, and he would go as a light to the Gentiles. That continues to happen. And they prophesied that there would be a national turning, and the Messiah would be welcomed by his people, and they'd look to him whom they pierced. Hey, Yehuda, got a break, got to run. I kept John from us this entire half hour, which is a rare thing to do. But I want to urge you, step back. Digest the reason I can relate well to people who differ is because I do my best to digest the answers. Digest the answers. Digest this. Pray for God to give you insight, and it could change your life. We'll be back with much more. Stay with us.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us today on the Line of Fire. Okay, I was broadcasting from Orlando yesterday. Back, can I just say what my schedule's been for a few days? And in the meantime, you can call this number, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884, with your Jewish questions, Hebrew questions, on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Let's see, Thursday night of last week, flew into D.C. or Virginia, long delays with flights and got on later than expected, then ministered Friday day and night, Saturday day and night, Sunday morning, afternoon, flew back Sunday night, delays on that flight. Home on Monday for a typically blessed busy day of ministry and radio and writing. Tuesday, after the show, did an intensive workout and then to the airport with more flight delays, got into Orlando well past midnight. Had to leave the hotel at 8 in the morning for a TV shoot in Orlando yesterday. By the way, two wonderful interviews. I mean, really blessed interviews. One on The Real Kosher Jesus with Daniel Kalender, our grad, who's the successor of Reinhard Bonnke at Christ for All Nations Ministries. And then one on Revival. I mean, we were all in tears. It was a very special time. Then did my radio broadcast, as you listened yesterday, live from Orlando. Flew in last night. No flight delays last night, thankfully. Home today. This is one of these things I unpack to pack. You ever done that? You have to unpack in order to pack. And pack tonight. God willing, leave for India tomorrow afternoon. We'll have a specially prepared broadcast for you. So please pray for me on the journey. We arrive at our destination, God willing, about 36 hours after leaving. And I'll be broadcasting. The plan is at least Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday next week, live from India. So as you'll be listening to me next week at this hour, this moment, it'll be past 2 a.m. as we broadcast from India, the middle of the night. But we've got our portable high-tech radio equipment we'll be traveling with, carrying on the plane with us, and bringing over to India. So those are always special times. Thank you for those who've stood with us. And if you could help with a gift to help with this India trip, it would mean so much to us, just further encouragement as we go over. We're not going there to fundraise. You understand we're going there to pour into pastors and leaders that will be coming together for a special celebration to honor my dear friend Yesu Padam on his 60th birthday. And it just could be a unique time to impart vision and courage and strength to many leaders and church planters that will be coming from all over. If you'd like to stand with us, give us a call, 1-800-278-9978. 1-800-278-9978. Your gift, large or small, would just be a blessing. If you feel prompted to do it, please do. Or go to askdrbrown.org. Askdrbrown.org. Right on the homepage, you can donate. And I've got a really neat announcement to make to you shortly, so stay with me. Questions on our Ask Dr. Brown Facebook page. Curtis, do current Jews still sacrifice lambs and stuff like we read about in the Old Testament? No, since the temple's been destroyed in the year 70, sacrifices have not been offered. However, I want to give two caveats. Samaritans, which are a very, very tiny group in Israel today, but trace their roots back to northern Israel. You can read about this in 2 Kings chapter 17. Samaritans still sacrifice a lamb at Passover and things like that. And at the Day of Atonement, there are religious Jews who have a ritual. It's called kapara, which is they take a chicken or a hen for man or for woman, kill the animal, and then swing it around their heads and say, this is my substitute, this is my atonement. And then they will then sometimes take the proceeds from that, the money that would have paid for a chicken or hen, and give it to the poor. It is a custom that is well entrenched in many parts of the Jewish world and completely rejected by others. To me, it reflects the recognition for a need of atonement, of a sacrifice, of a substitute. But the sacrificial system, Passover sacrifice, all that. No, not at all. Not with the temple destroyed. And Jews will not do it nationally until the temple is rebuilt, if that happens. Back with your questions. Whole lot more. Stay with us.
Fire we want, for fire we please. Send the fire.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thank you so much for joining us on The Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884, Thursday, Jewish Thursday. Today I'm answering a lot of questions that have been posted on Facebook page, giving you some insights from Hebrew scriptures, meaning of Hebrew words, Jewish background as relevant, taking your calls as well. Before I go further, a couple weeks back, during the first hour, we had Scott Lindsay, who's a ministry liaison with Logos Bible Software, talking about the software. And when we dialogued about him coming on the air, I said, okay, here's the deal. If you come on the air, we need to have two objectives. Number one, we need to really make it an edifying, interesting show for our listeners. And that succeeded completely. Fascinating how the software can be used, encouraging folks to dig deeper in the Word. A single click of your mouse could bring together, say, 70 different resources that may have cost $2,000 to buy, and you've got them on your computer for $250. And you've got hundreds of others sitting there as well. And with one click, you can bring them all together and see what they're saying on these different subjects and so on, and open up the various verses in the Hebrew and Greek. And anyways, fascinating, excellent, good show. I said, the other thing is, because it costs us money to be on radio, we need to have some type of way that as we bless our listeners, that they're able to stand with us. So Logos said, here's what we'll do. Every order that comes through the special Logos Line of Fire website, where people mention Line of Fire when they call in, we'll give 15% of that to the Line of Fire. And for that week only, they said, we'll do something we never do. In fact, Scott said, mark my words, you know, this is a tremendous deal. 15% discount on any base package. So, for example, you could get as a base package something just a Bible study library with 275 books worth $4,500, and it's only $265, but there'd be a 15% discount for the Line of Fire listeners. You go all the way up through the Platinum Scholars Library, which I have, and is mind-boggling what's available. And that'll be on my computer as I travel to India, just downloading that today. As I travel to India, which means I'll have a library that would almost fill the plane right there at my fingertips as I travel. So anyway, the week was so successful. So many of you ordered the products that they've extended in an ongoing way that any order, you can order any single book, you can get a package. They'll donate 15% to us, which is so wonderful because this helps us in work that's touching people in America and around the world. But I just found this out yesterday. I was amazed. They're indefinitely extending the 15% discount if you use the Line of Fire coupon code. All right? So if you get any base package, which in some cases can save you a few hundred dollars because of the size of the package, you'll get a 15% discount, and we'll still get the 15% donation from them. So take advantage of this, all right? You'll be blessed, we'll be blessed, and you'll be working with a fine company. Go to logos.com/lineoffire, logos.com/lineoffire, or just when you order, use the coupon code lineoffire, all one word, lineoffire, one word, or you can call this number to order, all right? Let me give it to you, 1-800-875-6467, 1-800-875-6467. And just mention the Line of Fire as your coupon code. If you get a base package, you get the discount. And whatever you order, we'll get the 15% donation. So I'm thrilled. I'm absolutely thrilled. And here we're getting people to study and dig, getting the Word more and more and more. So it's win-win for everybody. All right, to the phones. Todd in Tampa, Florida, thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Well, how are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing great, Todd. Always nice to hear from you, buddy.
Oh, I'll tell you, you're great at apologetics.
Hey, well, it's nice to be on the side of truth. You know, I've done debates for years, and often I'll be told, well, you just didn't have a good debating opponent, or it should have been a different rabbi, or this person on the homosexual activist side, they weren't the best representative. And I said, you know, maybe it's not that
maybe
I'm such a good debater. Maybe we're on the side of truth. Maybe that's why we're coming out well by God's grace.
Yeah, you know,
what's your question today, Todd?
Well, my question is truly Orthodox rabbis and those of the Jewish faith, what do they call the 12 disciples that Jesus chose? Do they accept them as existing? And what is their opinion of them?
First, for the most part, they would not care about this any more than your average Christian would care, or let's say your committed pastor would mm-hmm. care about who the first followers of Muhammad were. That's
right.
The first thing. However, if for the most part, they would accept that they existed. There is even a Talmudic reference, derogatory reference to Jesus and some of his disciples. So they would accept that they existed, and they would look at them as either misled or misleaders, and probably both. There are some Orthodox Jewish views that paint Jesus as a terrible deceiver. There are others that would just look at him as some Jewish guy. We don't even know who he was, and it was his followers who started this false religion and made him into something that would have shocked him.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the original disciples, whether they accept there were 12 or not, they might not. But they would certainly, generally speaking, believe that there were these disciples, there were these followers, they were Jews, and they started a heretical, dangerous movement, if not them immediately, then Paul and their disciples. And they would either look at them as tragically misled or as wicked men who were outright deceivers, one of the two.
Right, because I mean, if they knew they were following the truth, obviously a person who knew if it was a lie would not sacrifice their life for a lie. And that's
right.
That's
now again, I believe that is a strong argument. In other words, that if you know for sure that what you're standing for is false, that you've been misled and deceived,
mm-hmm.
you're not going to do something noble and heroic.
Right.
Now, if you are misled, if you believe something and you are genuinely deluded, we see deluded people doing fanatical things all the time. We see deluded people blowing themselves up in the name of Islam and killing innocent men, women, children, and themselves,
right.
thinking that they're going to go to some Islamic paradise with
and
70 perpetual,
by 72 virgins. And
perpetual virgins, by the way. So after
oh, okay.
sexual acts, they remain perpetual virgins. And, yeah, I mean, the whole thing, of course, just bizarre. But it's all the more tragic because that's part of the lie that
right.
seduces some of these deluded people. Now, the bigger question from an apologetic angle is this. Would someone who just had a hallucination about the Messiah rising from the dead sacrifice their life? Did they actually have to see that person rise? That would be the greater argument because, look, people lose loved ones. We grieve. Mm-hmm. We agonize. We desperately wish it wasn't true. We have a dream that we were talking to them after they died, and yet we know they're gone.
Right.
So for a whole movement to be based on a resurrection that never happened, that is a strong argument on behalf of the resurrection of Jesus. Now one last point to make, because it is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with the Lubavitcher Jews, Hasidic Jews?
Somewhat.
Okay.
A few points here and there, somewhat.
All right. They are a large Hasidic ultra-Orthodox group based actually in Brooklyn, New York. They are all around the world because they have a missionary mentality to reach Jews around the world. And they send out their shluchim, their emissaries, their apostles, so to say, to reach Jews around the world. And I'm friendly with a number of them. And it was interacting with them in 73 that really prompted me. I need to study Hebrew and learn these things more. Well, many of them believe that their leader, Menachem Mendel Schneerson, who died in 1994 at the age of 92, was actually the Messiah. And they were expecting him, many of them, he had a terrible stroke and was incapacitated largely the last 2 years of his life. Many were expecting him to miraculously come out of that stroke. He didn't. He died. Many said that he would rise from the dead. He didn't. Many still believe that he did spiritually rise, that he's spiritually present with them, that if you went in the grave, he wouldn't physically be there. It is simply a test to see if they truly believe. Some refer to him coming again. Now, you could say, well, that proves that even without a resurrection, then you can have a whole movement. No, actually, it doesn't, because the messianic part of their movement has really gotten very, very small because he didn't rise. And even though the group goes on as devoted Jews, reverencing their former leader, they recognize he didn't rise. So they go on with their beliefs, those Jewish beliefs. But if the beliefs were only about their leader because he didn't rise, they would have all fizzled. All right, I'm going to try to get to a few more questions on the other side of the break. Stay with us.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on the Line of Fire on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, 866-34-TRUTH. There was a question that I was asked on my personal Facebook page. I do almost all the interaction with the radio show every day on the Ask Dr. Brown page because I've been out of room on the personal Facebook page for ages because it only allows you 5,000 friends. But I want to answer this one, a couple of questions quickly from the personal page. Dar wanted to know this. Was there really a Hebrew manuscript of Matthew that predates the Greek, or did it postdate it? We do not have a Hebrew copy of Matthew that predates any Greek version. All of the copies we have of Matthew, the oldest copies, are in Greek. And when Matthew is quoted by the Greek church leaders, they quote it from the Matthew that we have. Now, there is a church tradition, beginning with Papias, that says that there was a Hebrew Matthew, or that Matthew took the Hebrew sayings of Jesus. Some would argue it meant Aramaic. Some even claim he wrote in a Semitic style. But we don't know. Did that mean an original gospel of Matthew in Hebrew? There's a Talmudic statement that mentions Hebrew gospel. All right, so that exists some centuries later, attesting that. Some of the church leaders mentioned some of the Jewish believers had a Hebrew Matthew or another book as well in Hebrew. Some claim that it should say Aramaic. There's really debate about it. But let's just say that there was either a Hebrew version of Matthew, or that there was a version of the sayings of Jesus in Hebrew, translated from Aramaic into Hebrew, or that were originally spoken by Yeshua in Hebrew. These are all fair questions to ask. Let's just say it existed. If it did exist, we don't have it. Not a word of it. We don't have it. All right? All we have is the Greek. Greek scholars of Matthew have told me that in their view, Matthew is not a translation. It was written originally in Greek, which means if there was a Hebrew Matthew, that was one book he wrote, and then he wrote another in Greek. What we do know is we have the Greek, period. Now, there are Hebrew Matthews from centuries later. These were translations by rabbis who were dealing with Christians and wanting to refute them, so they translated the Greek into Hebrew. Now, what's interesting is that in some places, there are plays on words in the Hebrew. Well, why would you have that if you're a rabbi translating something from Greek into Hebrew and you're against it? Why would you have a word play? You know, that would be something you'd find in the original. All right? So there are some claims by some scholars that some of the medieval Hebrew Matthews that we have reflect an original Hebrew Matthew. Is it possible? It's possible. Period. That's all we can say. It's possible. What we do know is that every ancient Matthew manuscript we have is in Greek. All right, so whatever we do with later manuscripts in Hebrew, we have to do with a massive question mark until we have further evidence that this could reflect an original text. Or even if it should reflect an original text, it could just be another way that something was passed down and Matthew wrote what we have in Greek for us. So when people say, well, the original Hebrew Matthew, there is no original Hebrew Matthew. We don't have that. If it did exist, we don't have it. Or there's some hints of it in later medieval manuscripts, perhaps. Yochanan, I live in Israel and I'm a believer in Yeshua in 34 years. In recent times have been many people who said that the Messiah's name is Yahushua. You know Hebrew like me. What do you say? Nonsense! Nonsense? Nonsense. The only people who say Yahushua are the ones who don't know Hebrew well. His name was Yahshua. Nonsense! There's no such Hebrew name existed. Now that leads me to a question on the Ask Dr. Brown Facebook page. Is the name Jesus a very real name scripturally or just a man-made one? Yeah, Kathy, thanks for asking. It's a real name. It's the English way of saying Jesus, which ultimately comes from the Greek Jesus. And I want to repeat this. Yes, the name of Jesus was originally Yeshua. And the full form would be Yehoshua, Joshua. And then Yeshua is the short form of that. We know that well, right? There's no debating and disputing the existence of that. The pronunciation with the ion at the end could have been pronounced a little differently, all right? But that just has to do with Yeshua, all right? But when God gave us the New Testament, he gave it to us in Greek, which meant don't worry about the pronunciation. Know who the person is and say it the way you say it in your language. So if you live in Italy, you say Jesu. And if you're in Israel, you say Yeshua. That would be the original. If you're in English, in America, say Jesus. Greek, Jesus. That's just fine. That's an accurate presentation. All right. Who asked this great question? Luke. Is there a connection between the Memra in the Aramaic Targumim of Genesis and the Logos in John chapter 1? Absolutely yes. And you're saying, what's he talking about? Luke, I'm going to start tomorrow, one of the hours tomorrow. I don't know which one yet. I'm going to address that. Well, tell you what, I'll make that the second, the last half hour of the broadcast tomorrow. I plan to address that. Clay, remind me to do that. I address this in great length in Volume 2 of Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus. But, Luke, just get the real kosher Jesus because I have a section in the book about that, all right? But absolutely, there's a question between the member of the Aramaic Targumim of Genesis and really the whole of the Hebrew Scriptures and the Logos in John chapter 1. And for those who are saying, okay, great answer to the question, but I don't understand the question, we will take that up. We will take that up tomorrow as well. Hey, friends, please pray for me as I leave for India. God willing, I'll be going again in December, my annual trip, but this is an extra trip that was not scheduled. One of my closest friends in the world, Yesu Padam, a man who's been stoned for his faith, for preaching the gospel, often under death threats, often with his family under death threats, has preached and stood just the same. And we've been side by side in some literally life-threatening situations where I knew to preach and stand and he knew to preach and stand, and it could have cost us. It's been our privilege. He's turning 60. It's an honor because as an untouchable, he was a nobody dying on the side of the road, literally, when a Canadian missionary found him and then brought him to a hospital where he was rehabilitated. But he was so hostile to the caste system. He lived in rebellion and hatred for years. Atheist, alcoholic, violent, communist. Jesus appeared to him in his mid-20s. He's been passionately following the Lord ever since. I'm going there for his birthday, but you have to understand it's India. Pastors and leaders will be coming from all over. I'm going there to minister to the pastors and leaders, and I just believe it's going to be a time of great visionary impartation that could have a massive impact on many lives. So pray if you could help us with a gift of financial support, because these trips are costly, and while we're there, obviously we don't generate funds. Help us with your gift, 1-800-278-9978. 1-800-278-9978. And God willing, next week we'll be broadcasting live from India. I can hardly wait to do that. Go online, askdrbrown.org. Just click on donate and stand with us. 1-800-278-9978. My bottom line, burn bright, burn bright, burn bright for Jesus. The time is short. We only have one life. Make it count. Make it worthwhile. Live in fullness of the promises and reality of God while you have breath.